water, living with hydrometeorological extremes. This is the fourth in the 2014 FENA Forum series, hosted by the FENA School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University. This forum took place on the 7th of October 2014.
Well, thank you all for coming in such large numbers. As you know, obviously today we'll be talking about how to continue living with hydrometeorological extremes, floods and droughts, you might say for sure. But before we carry on, I'd like to acknowledge that we're here on Ngunnawal country. We acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose traditional lands we are meeting today. So we've got four speakers today, are really only three. I'm just here doing the master ceremony work today. We've got three speakers. We've got Dr. Rob Fortesi, Director of Meteorology and CEO of the Bureau of Meteorology. And those of you who wonder what the difference is between those two roles, maybe he'll explain it. I'm not sure. He's the boss of the Bureau of Meteorology. That's what it comes down to. Dr. Martin Wolf, Director of Climate Hazard and Risk Section in Geosciences Australia. And Mr. Norm Miller, a principal hydrologist with the GAD here in Canberra. And so welcome to our speakers. Before we go on, just as an introduction, you might have read the blurb on the internet. So my name is Albert van Dijk. I should say that I'm a professor here at the FENA School of Water Science and Management. When you read the blurb for this meeting, you might have noticed, you might have read some text. And I guess for those that haven't, I just want to give a bit of context to this forum today. What is it about? What are we trying to discuss here? You may have seen some images of our Prime Minister about February, I think, of this year, visiting drought-struck countryside in Queensland and New South Wales. And as he went there, they had a tremendous rain shower. And so he had to run for cover, quite literally. As he said himself, today is good soaking rain, but it doesn't mean that the drought is over. Now that raises some questions then, doesn't it? What is a drought really, if not a lack of rain? How much rain do you need to end a drought? How much lack of rain does it need before a drought starts? These are all good questions. Of course, we all know droughts and floods are characteristic of Australia. I won't recite the poem, but they continue to be treated as exceptional events. And so you can really ask yourself, when is a flood, if you know that there's going to be floods, there's going to be droughts, when is a flood an exceptional flood? And when is a drought an exceptional drought? So here we see some newspaper articles from ABC Rural, the drought impedes flood recovery in a coal mine catchment. That sounds a bit ironic, doesn't it? The drought impedes flood recovery. And yet, that is how it's reported and that's how it's understood. Here's another example to the contrary. Flood evacuations in a drought-hit Queensland town. Okay, so does that mean that the drought is over or is the drought still there, but there's also a flood going on? So really, we have to deal with this alternation of quite severe, often, floods and droughts, and how do we do that better? Of course, predictions are that the frequency and severity of hydrological extremes will increase, and may be compounded by meteorological extremes, such as heat waves. So at the top here, we see a Perth Dam, and to the right of it, we see a step change, if you like. That's certainly how it's interpreted in this graph, from relatively high inflows, and then suddenly around 1975, a drop in inflows, and then more recently, another few drops. Now, I'm not here to defend the choice of these steps, but of course, all of us will probably agree that there seems to be quite a dramatic change in inflows in the dam. Recently that has been attributed to climate change. Again, I'm not here to defend that study, but there's certainly an understood role for climate change. At the bottom here, you see that across Australia, there's quite a dramatic increase in extreme temperatures. Now, of course, temperature is not the same as water, but if it's hotter, people use more water. If it's hot, there's more evaporation from the catchments. If it's hot, we've got all sorts of connections between the temperature and the water cycle. You have bushfires, all those sorts of things. They compound the general issue of droughts, less so of floods, arguably. At the same time, our vulnerability to hydrometeorological extremes has increased because of the greater pressure on water resources. So in the drought, in the millennium drought, as we like to call it, that we had from 2001 to 2009, we had to choose to some extent, or choices were being made for us. Do we let orchards die, or do we let wetlands die? Do we let lakes go saline, or do we get unhappy irrigators? You might recall this scene, or maybe not. These are irrigators, I think, in Griffith or thereabouts, anyway, in Murrumbidgee, burning basin plans. So there was the Murray Darling Basin Authority went around the Murray Darling Basin to explain the basin plan. Unfortunately for them, that coincided again with the end of the drought. It started raining a lot. So no one was really particularly receptive to this idea. People said, look, what are they talking about? It's raining again. And irrigators, of course, their livelihoods depend on this. So they got a lot to lose, and they didn't like it. And that had quite an impact on the acceptance, if you like, of the basin plan. Of course, in our cities, also in Canberra, we know about the annoyances of neighbours that use too much water when there's restrictions or the wrong days or whatsoever. So, you know, we've got some pain to potentially carry here as well. On the flood side, our rapid growth has the potential to put ever more people, businesses, and infrastructure at risk. This is a picture of flooding during the big Brisbane floods. And as you can see, there's whole neighbourhoods that are flooded. Now, you can rightly question, should we have built there? Of course, with hindsight, that's an easy question to answer. But, you know, you can also ask yourself the question, you know, was there really enough information and was there really enough planning that went into it to prevent this massive scale of flooding? Get an open question, not suggesting a question, an answer to the question. Changes in climate, land, and water conditions are making some ecosystems more vulnerable. So this is what used to be a wetland at the low end of the Murray River, at Chewilla floodplains. And as the Monty Python mob would say, this is an X tree. This tree is not going to benefit from any watering. This forest is dead. And so we have to ask ourselves some questions. What are we going to try and save? Are we trying to save the heritage? So all these things, they give a tremendous challenge to the hydrologists, to the water planners, the water managers, to all of us in trying to work out how we're going to respond to the future, how we're going to prepare for the future. The common assumption in hydrology and water management has been for many years that the past is a good guide to the future. Of course, with climate change, with increasing development, increasing water use, that may no longer be the case. The road ahead of us might look like this, or we might not even be able to see what the road ahead of us looks like, to be more precise. There are generally no more easy solutions. I mean, this would be an easy solution. This man is washing his car in the rain. You would suggest, don't worry, mate, the rain will take care of it. There's not many solutions like that. You know, the flexibility in our water use is pretty diminished. It means that if we make one decision, we'll be probably affecting other potential benefits. So here's an example from a Marsden and Jacobs report as to what we can do and what are the costs of making more water available in some of the big cities, Sydney, LA, Perth, and Newcastle water supply systems. So you can express that, of course, in dollars per kiloliter. You can express it in different units, but here it is in kiloliters. Others would be, for instance, greenhouse gas emissions, which tend to align reasonably well, but not entirely. So we can go from the top. We can look at catchment thinning. We can remove the trees. Trees tend to use a bit more water than grass does, and so taking the trees out might give us a bit more water. Not everyone might be happy with that, particularly not if it's a natural forest. We can take water from the irrigators. They might not like that. And on the more expensive end of the scale down here, we can install rainwater collection systems on each and every one of our houses. That's actually really expensive. It's also expensive if you look in terms of energy use, for instance. You know, you can see all the equipment that had to be made, and it's using energy. So that's not necessarily, it might make us feel good, but it's not necessarily a very good solution to our water problems. And then, of course, there's the old chestnut of water pipelines that usually gets mooted by someone as the ideal solution. Yes, we can build pipelines. We know how to do it, but the water has to go uphill typically at some point, and that is really, really expensive. Also, again, in emissions, so there's a feedback to the climate system there potentially. And in between, you see all these other options. Yes, we can build new dams, but somebody's probably living in that catchment that's going to be flooded. We can do all sorts of other things. We can start using groundwater. That's finite, too. We can try and reuse stormwater or grey water. Not everyone likes to drink that. So there's no really easy solutions, and still we have to find solutions. Then you might rightly ask, what is the difference between a natural disaster and poor planning? I mean, if we know that there's going to be floods and droughts, we can prepare for them. When does, you know, what's the sort of due diligence in preparing? When is something so exceptional that you can't expect anyone to prepare for that? Or indeed, a water management authority. So you will know that in the Brisbane floods, people who managed the Wivenhoe catchment got a lot of flack for the way that they did that. Farmers, there's two schools of thought of them on that. One is that the market sorted out, these farms need to prepare better, and other people that point at, you know, the fact that these are humans with families and businesses that need to survive. So here's some perspectives then that I hope might come out in the discussion today, and we can have fruitful discussions about. I talked to Steve Dovers, our director, about this, and we came up with a few ideas about, you know, what are the sort of contrasting perspectives that people might take to this discussion. So you could talk about, you know, yes, it might be a natural disaster or it might be a planning failure. You could emphasize individual risk-taking. You know, does farmers want to farm? That's their risk. Or you could say the government is here to protect us. You could talk about the fact that the natural environment needs to have priority, or maybe people's livelihoods should have priority. You can say we can fix everything with technology, with engineering, or you could say, no, there's an end to that. We're reaching the end to that, and we need to think about behavioral and attitude changes. You can believe that incremental adjustment will get us there. Don't worry, we'll get there. Or you might say we really need to radically overhaul our system. And then finally, you might say we need to educate and empower people, not tell them what to do. We need to give them, you know, the freedom and the intelligence, the information to make their own decisions. Or you could say we need to tell them how to better deal with floods and droughts. So there's some perspectives that you can take to this, and hopefully we'll find some of that come out. So here's the three big questions for today that our speakers will address, and also that we'll talk a bit more about after that. The question one is, what will be the greatest challenges to coping with droughts and floods over the next decade? What is really going to hit us, or what might hit us, that we haven't prepared well enough for? Question two, what new solutions are available? How can they be implemented? Now, as I said before, probably there's no easy solutions, but maybe there are some easy solutions, but also difficult solutions are solutions. And question three, what new information, knowledge, skills, and training will be required? What does the next generation of experts, or the next generation of Australians indeed, need to know and be able to do to help us through the future? So that's where I'm ending it. And then I would like to hand over to Rob Fertessi, as I said, Director of Meteorology and CEO of the Bureau of Meteorology, for his views on the virtual topic for today.
Yep. Thanks, Albert. Great to be here today. Thanks for the invitation. Always impressed at how Albert can put a bit of Monty Python dialogue into a presentation. It's a rare skill. I'm going to talk a little bit about hydrometeorological extremes today. Hopefully I can answer some of those questions, or at least provide some perspectives on them. I wanted to make a few prefacing points here. First of all, just to point out that Australia is endowed with one of the world's most variable climates. And that, as a consequence, has got a very large impact on us, whether it's economically or socially or on our environment. It has significant effects. We're lucky that we have an excellent observational record on climate parameters, but we need to face up to the fact that it is actually comparatively short. It's a little over 100 years old in terms of being able to describe the continent as a whole. For certain parts of Australia, it's a bit longer than that. But we'd be fools to imagine that every possible climate possibility may have appeared before our eyes in that 100 and a bit years. So we do need to be mindful of that. One thing that is striking, however, is in the last decade, we have actually witnessed the most dramatic swings in climate that we have witnessed in that 100-plus years of record. And on top of that, we know now that our climate is no longer stationary. In other words, it's not a static thing. It is now trending in a particular way. And I want to talk a little bit about that in my talk. And a basic thesis of my talk and where I'm going to end up is that one of our best ways of coping with that is better intelligence on the way in which we are actually tracking climate and related environmental responses, like hydrologic responses in particular. So let's have a look at why do we have this remarkably variable hydrometeorology. And it's chiefly because we've got some very powerful climatic influences in our region. Out in the Pacific, we have the El Niño Southern Oscillation. Out in the Indian Ocean, we have the Indian Ocean Dipole. Both of those are more or less affected by pressure differentials that occur on either sides of those oceans and drive prevailing winds in certain ways. We have, of course, the effect of the Asian monsoon in the north. And in the south, we have this thing called the Southern Annular Mode, which is associated with a circumpolar vortex of winds that move around the south pole. We have the subtropical ridge, high-pressure ridge, that moves a bit northward on some years and a bit southward in other years. And we have some more localised effects like the East Coast lows and stuff that affect Sydney and surrounding areas. Depending on how these forces are operating, these set up our climate from year to year, how much rainfall we get, and to some extent also the temperatures that we experience as well. So understanding hydrometeorological extremes is the key to, or understanding these things is the key to understanding our hydrometeorological extremes. Over the last decade, as you've heard already from Albert, we have witnessed the most severe drought that Australia has witnessed in our living or historical memory. That period of about a decade saw some of the driest rainfalls over a good three-quarters of our country. And the expression of that is probably best understood has been the declining inflows in the into the catchments of the Murray-Darling Basin. Our storage has got down to around 18% or so. As you know, there was a dramatic drying of the lower lakes and ensuing acidification problems. And for a couple of seasons, many irrigation districts got no water allocations whatsoever. So it had crippling economic and environmental consequences. We saw something similar happen in our cities. Here we're showing a similar downward trend in inflows into the Melbourne water supply catchment, as Albert showed for the Perth water supply catchments. They're the most famous ones. But it was these types of changes that actually triggered an absolute gold rush in terms of the development of new water supply infrastructure. The urban water industry in Australia for the couple decades prior to that were very, very averse to investing in infrastructure. When the millennium drought struck, the industry had to spend like drunken sailors to get desalination plants in, to get water grids in place to stop cities from drying out or running out of water completely. That turns out to be a very, very effective and quick response, which is great. You can do that in the cities with desalination. Much, much harder to do in rural Australia. But now most of the capital cities have got a high degree of water security associated with them because of that additional water supply. No sooner had the millennium drought come to an end, we then had the wettest two-year period in the living memory of Australia. So the two La Niña years of 10-11 and 11-12 brought the wettest two-year period that we had ever observed. And that had the well-known effects of flooding. Again, Albert's shown you an example of Brisbane under flood. But that does not point out, as this diagram does, of the sheer pervasive spread of major flooding. Every one of those red triangles is a river gauge that attained the major flood level, which is the top of a three-level category that actually is the most serious in terms of impacts on townships. It may require evacuation of towns in some instances, or the evacuation of stock, or considerable infrastructure damage. So we broke many, many records during that time. The consequent economic cost was of the order of about $15 billion of those floods over those 2 years. We had record floods at over 120 sites through that area, and many towns were flooded multiple times. And one of the most remarkable was at St George in inland Queensland on the Condamine River, where the prior record flood last set back in 1890 at 13.1 metres was actually beaten three times in 2 years. This was the so-called one-in-a-hundred-year flood, beaten three times in 2 years. So quite remarkable swing from the absolute most desiccated to the absolute most saturated condition that we had ever observed in the country. No sooner had the La Niña years passed that we are now returning probably to a more natural state of affairs, where drought once again is finding itself expressed in the Australian landscape. These two graphs here, or maps here, show the failed wet season over the last 2 years in Western Queensland and Northern New South Wales, where we now have some significant drought conditions prevailing. This shows the rainfall percentiles. All the areas shown in red are considerably below average rainfall. And the map on the right actually shows the classification of rainfall deficiencies, which we use as a bit of a surrogate for drought extent these days. So this is really showing areas that have received either anything below the lowest tenth percentile of rainfall, all going down to the lowest on record for the darkest red colours. So already we're back now to a period where there is exceptional circumstance style payments being paid to farmers to cope with this drought. Layered on top of this variability and the extent to which those recent conditions have been affected by climate change is unclear. But we do know that there are very, very powerful environmental forces prevailing now which are resulting in systematic climate change, chiefly the systematic warming of the planet. The planet has warmed about a degree over the last century, and most of that has been since the middle of the last century as the greenhouse effect has accelerated. That is expressed in many, many ways, in the melting of the cryosphere, in the warming of the oceans, in the warming of the atmosphere, and so on. So we do see some very, very significant effects, and these are starting to play out on hydrometeorological variability as well. Probably the most clear way in which that is being expressed is in temperature, and again, Albert showed you a nice diagram at the beginning that shows the prevalence of extreme heat waves in recent times. This is another way of showing it. Basically, what we're doing here is we're binning temperature data into three time periods, maximum temperatures on the left and minimum temperatures on the right, and showing how the distribution of those temperatures, roughly in a normal distribution as shown here, is moving to the right hand of the diagram. If we look at just the left-hand diagram for a moment and look at the prevalence of extreme weather, that's high temperatures that exceed the two standard deviations of the norm, we find it used to be exceeded about 2% of the time, now being exceeded about 10% of the time. So that's a five-fold increase in extreme temperatures since the middle of the last century. And conversely, with minimum temperature records, we see the opposite trend. So we're now seeing hot records outnumbering cold records about 3-1, whereas they used to be even prior to the advent of climate change. And 2013, is, as you all know, was our hottest year on record. And this shows the anomalies throughout 2013. Red days where it was warmer than normal, blues where it was cooler than normal through that time of year. So this was the hottest year by a considerable margin for Australia. In terms of the rainfall signal, it's a lot less clear. In fact, we are getting quite a bit more rainfall in the north. But there is some systematic drying of the southern regions of this country, attributable in part to climate change, but also in part into changes in ozone levels in the southern hemisphere. And what this map here attempts to show is the reductions in rainfall in the southwest and the southeast of the country that are now considerably drier and are projected to become drier again in the future. What the models show is that there is great conformity in model projections in terms of future temperatures for the country. So whether you're talking about a low emission scenario or a high emission scenario, they're all pointing to a warmer future for Australia and most of the globe through to the end of the century. But the picture is a lot less clear for rainfall. Areas that are stippled or are hashed there, rather, are areas where there is not agreement with the various global climate models that are being used now to project these changes. And it is only for the high emission scenario that there are a couple of regions in Australia, the southwest and southeast Queensland, where there is reasonable confidence that those climate change models are actually agreeing on the trend in rainfall. The general trend, however, in all of these models is for the mid-latitude areas to dry out somewhat, and there's very significant differences between the low emissions and the high emissions scenarios, as there is for temperature as well. So we know that if we remain on increasing the greenhouse effect, that we will increase the likelihood of droughts, but also paradoxically floods as well. Because a warmer world is a wetter world. For every degree we raise the temperature, we raise the water holding capacity of the atmosphere by about 7%. So that means that there should be a lot more rainfall. But what really matters is the way in which that is distributed spatially and temporally. And we're still working on what that looks like. I want to end my talk by asserting that I think one of the best strategies for dealing with this is enhancing our environmental intelligence, and we define that, or I define that here, as conclusions that we would draw from either environmental models or data that actually guide decisions about preparedness and response to these types of hydrometeorological extremes. And this is pretty much the Bureau's mission statement. I want to finish by talking about a few examples of the types of environmental intelligence products that the Bureau is developing and how these can be used to actually guide decision-making given the advent of growing hydrometeorological variability. The first of these I want to point to is data analysis. In this instance here, where we are going back over all of the old rainfall records for the country and expressing these in terms of the intensity, frequency, duration spectra of the rainfall. This is a critical input into engineering design, whether you're designing a gutter on a roof or a major culvert under a road or a desalination plant or a dam spillway. You need to know something about the spectra of rainfall intensity, frequency, duration. The Bureau is working with Engineers Australia to produce a revision, the first since 1987, using a huge amount of additional data that has been gathered since that time and also applying new methods. A second example is in the enhancement of numerical weather prediction. So this has now got to the point where our ability to actually forecast the weather and increasingly rainfall is getting better and better every year, and it's getting to the point now where it probably should really be used by dam engineers for managing reservoir inflows and outflows. In the past, it was deemed to be a little bit too crude a science, in other words, not able to get down to the spatial and temporal resolution the dam engineers need. But the resolution of the models today and their skill, their accuracy, their reliability is becoming such that now, I think, 7-day numerical weather prediction forecasts are of adequate skill to be used in reservoir operations. So this is a great thing for helping us properly plan responses to very, very heavy rainfall on set. Another area is in the hydrologic forecasting. So we've been in a position where we've been able to predict rainfall out to 7 days. We're now getting ourselves into a position where we can now predict what the river flows will be 7 years out. This is the first operational service in Australia and one of the very, very few in the world that the Bureau is now putting in place. for a range of river gauging locations around the country. We'll shortly be issuing public forecasts for 7 days ahead for river levels that can be used for all kinds of things relating from flood-related issues through to water releases for environmental flows and the like. Another example here is the seasonal stream flow forecasting, again, a first for Australia and a relatively unique service around the world, where we're now taking the climate outlooks that the Bureau publishes for 3 months ahead and producing similar types of forecasts for river inflows into storages or at key points on river sites. And what we see here on the left is a map showing the locations of the forecasts that the Bureau releases publicly every month for the next 3 months ahead. And on the right, the nature of the product that you get when you click on one of those dots, showing the historical range of flows that have occurred at that site, and then a comparison of the historical and the forecast probability distribution functions for those flows. So these are all examples of new environmental intelligence products that the Bureau is working on. And it's our belief that if we can get people out in industry using these products widely, that we increase our resilience to some of the economic, social, and environmental costs that enhanced hydrometeorological variability creates. Thanks.
I certainly hope you have some questions for Rob, but I'd like you to hold them for the panel discussion later on, if you don't mind. Next to the stand, I'd like to invite Martine Wolf from Geosciences Australia, who will take us through her views on this topic. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to take you through GA's view on living with hydrometeorological extremes. My name is Martine Wolf. I work in the Community Safety and Earth Monitoring Division. For those of you who are not familiar with GA, or perhaps not in this context, we're a technical agency in the industry portfolio, and our role is to give advice to government on all things related to geoscience and earth processes. And that includes, to some extent, on the impact of natural disasters. And I'll give you a view on that. I wanted to dive in a little bit on the definition side, going from the perspective of the UN agency that looks at disaster risk reduction. And it defines a hydrometeorological disaster as a process or phenomenon of atmospheric, hydrological, or oceanographic nature. And then it lists a long list of impacts. And from the perspective that we take at it, an extreme is an extreme, and it's natural, and it may shift how often particular severity occurs, but in principle, we know there will be extremes, and they will continue. The real moment an extreme turns into a disaster is when people are impacted, and the range of impact is enormous, and some of the previous speakers have given us examples. They range from anything physical that's damaged, including lives, to much less tangible, but psychological damage, also economic, and so forth. And that's the aspect of the disasters that we focus on very much at GA, that we need to understand how those damages are caused, because it doesn't actually need to be all that extreme to be a disaster. If people are ill-prepared, there is not sufficient planning, then you may have a less extreme event still turning into a disaster. So the policy environment within which some of this work occurs is that ultimately Australia has signed up to the Hyogo Framework for Action, and that's an initiative that's running for a number of years. It's coming to an end. It's being renewed at this moment. The Hyogo Framework for Action is a UN initiative that seeks to direct how we should undertake disaster risk reduction and prioritize the kind of actions that nations should seek to undertake. One of the real strong trends in that framework for action is the recognition that we need to understand how disasters occur, and in order to really build that resilience. And again, that chimes with things that both Albert and Rob have said. This is then echoed in a national disaster resilience strategy. That is the second picture with the nice sunset. I've never understood how sunsets point to resilience, but I'm sure there's a link there. The cursor, the italics at the top are from that policy. It is saying that underpinning a disaster-resilient community is the knowledge and understanding of local disaster risks. And I think that's something that that is going to run through my presentation. So the implementation of that strategy is governed by COAG, and it has a various set of different ways of kind of making that happen. One of them is that there are various subcommittees and technical reference groups that bring out guidelines, and they are supposed to be applied throughout government, but also private industry, on how to monitor, manage, model the natural disasters. And then there is several initiatives around data access, and I think that I'll give you some examples on that later. One of them is the National Flood Risk Information Project. And then finally, there's a very strong focus on research, and I would like to just mention the Bushfire Natural Hazard Research Program that's just kicked off last year. There's a 5 or 6 year research program that Albert is also part of and various other people in the audience. And that's really set to innovate the way that that we understand disasters from various aspects. But what I think is important to mention, that this is not just research done in various places of academic excellence, but it's actually driven and prioritized by stakeholders who need to actually deal with the disasters. And I think that's a very important aspect of a cooperative research center, that it can really deliver research that will feed into our ability to cope with the questions. The way that we at GA approach understanding natural disasters is by looking through the lens of impact, of how they affect us. So that has three components. The first one is we need to understand the hazard, and that is, how does the disaster develop? What kind of disaster are we looking at? Then the second one is the exposure. What are the elements that are exposed to the hazard that will be impacted, damaged? And then the third one is, how do they react to that hazard? And that's called the vulnerability. And I'll talk you through those elements next, if I manage to. Yeah. So we'll start with the hazard. I thought I'd put my textbook slide up from my high school of the hydrological cycle. I'm not going to talk you through each and every one of the hydrometeorological disasters, because when I looked at the list, it was pretty long. But I think, as Albert pointed out, what's really important to remember is that it's not the disasters, the extreme on their own, that become really a cause for concern. It's when they start triggering each other. And of course, a cyclone and a storm surge is a very easy thing to think about, but the heat wave and the drought that cause bushfires, there are landslides that are triggered by excessive rainfall, and there are even things such as epidemics that could be triggered by particular climatic circumstances. So I think when we think about hydrometeorological risks and disasters, it's worth thinking that a lot of these things could be triggered by each other, and they can even therefore start coinciding, and that's when the story gets really interesting, but also quite complicated. The thing to just to come back to is, if we try and model impacts and risks of disasters, is to understand the frequency distribution of these things, not necessarily, if we're trying to think about how we might mitigate this and build resilience, we need to understand the long-term profile of these things. So the long-term distribution, where they happen, how often, and what do they look like. The next element in this little triangle is the exposure. So these are the elements at risk, exposed to the disaster. Australia is a funny country, really, because there's about a few more people than the country that Albert and I come from, the Netherlands, but they all cluster around, it's such a huge continent, they all cluster around the side. There's not very even distribution. We are very much concentrated in a few locations, and this actually makes us quite vulnerable to disasters, because suddenly you hit a lot of people at the same time, and that has implications. So if we try and understand how the extreme events and the potential hazards affect those people, we need to really understand the environment in which we live to some amount of detail. And at this point, we need real significant information on the various elements in our environment. And that would be on the people that live there and their age profile and perhaps their health profile, but also on the houses we live in. What kind of construction are they? How are they built? Are they well maintained? What kind of roads have we got? Are they raised or not? Are they kind of paved or not? And so on and so forth. The infrastructure, potentially the agriculture. So at Geoscience, we've got what we call the National Exposure Information System. That's one database that's trying to harvest various databases that exist and make a unified, uniform view of what the exposure elements are like. But it's actually a very difficult problem because this information doesn't necessarily exist. So it's difficult to create. And then the final element is, okay, we think we have a handle on the elements, we have a handle on the disaster or on the hazard. Now, how does the hazard affect the elements at risk? This is what we call a vulnerability model. It tries to explain how assets, in this case houses or buildings, are damaged by a certain flood level in this case. So a certain intensity of hazard, could be a wind speed, could be a surge height. This is how much damage you would expect. The dots, incidentally, are actual observations from building surveys we've done after floods. I think this might be the Brisbane floods. It gives you a good impression of the variability you'll see in the actual landscape if you go out after a disaster. Houses don't all react in the same way, and there's various reasons for that. So you can see the kind of damage you might get on the right. You might get lots of debris, lots of mud, but you might also get subsidence and structural deterioration. So on the left there, we see the footprint, if we want to call it that, of an event. We know how big the flooding is, perhaps, or how big the wind footprint of the cyclone is, or this extreme event, how high the wind speeds are, how deep the water. Then we can translate that to the damage, to the impact. You can do the same for wind. So I'll give you another example. These vulnerability models need to be reasonably sophisticated because they need to be able to explain why, as actually happened in Cyclone Larry here, two buildings that were next to each other on one street, so experienced pretty much the same wind speed. One of them was and they were built in the same year because they're both government buildings. One of them was blown to a total loss, and the other one survived unscathed. So your models need to be sophisticated enough to predict that. Otherwise, it's a meaningless model. Okay, so we have the three elements, hazard, exposure, and risk. We put them together in the washing machine, and then we try and understand what the impact might look like. And you can do that in a quantitative manner. Here's an example of some work we did last year. It's a collaboration with various organizations, including a CSIRO and AIR Worldwide. We took some, and this is for a cyclone risk, but it's not for the current status of the climate, it's for what it would look like by 2100. So we've used climate projections for a particular emission scenario, and we have tried to understand what it would mean in terms of cyclone loss. Now, climate run was done by a global model, and that's reasonably coarse-grained, and it's usually not sufficiently detailed to actually understand what it would do for a cyclone risk in a particular country, let alone below the resolution of the country, especially not for these kind of smaller islands in the Pacific. So some of the techniques that we use in our risk modeling and long-term risk modeling are statistical, and they're very well suited to try and extrapolate and kind of smooth that out and try and understand that local risk. So based on that, we put it together with our understanding of the vulnerability and exposure in these islands, and we try to say, okay, on the current exposure, what would the cyclone risk look like by 2100? And you can see that the change in climate causes a change in risk, but it's not just the cyclones that drive it. It's also the way that the individual countries have their building stock, in this case this is a building stock picture, their building stock built and maintained, and where they live, of course. And that causes a signal that is kind of quite variable across the region. And again, it's the interaction between the three elements of that picture that drives that differentiation in risk. It's both changes in hazard as well as the vulnerability exposure. So that's a quantitative picture, and this kind of quantitative analysis can help you do all sorts of analysis around cost benefits of particular mitigation measures, be it land planning, be it all sorts of other things. I just wanted to mention the Productivity Commission into disaster funding arrangements. I don't know if you're aware of that. It's recently brought out its draft report about a week ago. And one of the statements that is, I've left out a sentence in between, but otherwise it's pretty much literally in there. It said, current natural disaster funding arrangements are not It said efficient as well, but I thought for the purpose here tonight, they're not sustainable. Government post-disaster support needs to be reduced and support for mitigation increased. Now, I'm not going to talk you through all the stuff in the report, but it's interesting that it recognizes that the way that disaster funding is going up, and a lot of that is related also to the way that we live in harm's way, it needs to be reduced and improved through mitigation, and it suggested that this is a good diagram to think about that. And that goes back to the things I've just been talking to you about. It's the understanding of the three elements that drive the impacts of the disasters, and the ability to, through policy in this case, provide kind of measures of mitigation in the form of land use planning and of building standards. And it's impossible to design those appropriately and sustainably unless you have a really good qualitative understanding of how this risk works. Otherwise, you could immensely over-engineer your solutions. We could all go and live in bunkers on stilts. We'd be fine, but it'd be a pretty expensive way to live. So this is supposedly a way in which you can optimize your solutions. Okay, I'm just going to give you a very quick flavor of some work that we are doing at GA on the kind of providing information out to various people, including the general public, household owners, but also industry and technical people around flood risk. Again, with the understanding that the better informed we are, the better our decisions can be in terms of mitigation. GA is undertaking the technical component of the National Flood Risk Information Portal. And we are about halfway through the project. It's about a four-year project. It's got three elements. The first is to provide access to flood studies. And these are flood studies that exist in the country that are undertaken by local governments and states, but aren't necessarily accessible to other people than the people who commissioned them. And this project seeks to address that by providing a platform to make them accessible. There's the second component, I think is the same component that Rob just mentioned. It's the revision of the Australian rainfall and runoff modelling by Engineers Australia. And this will really improve the quality of the flood modelling that's undertaken throughout the country. And then finally, the water observations from space. I'll give you a quick flavour of that. This is an analysis of the Landsat archive that we hold at Geoscience Australia. And what we've done is, through time, run an algorithm that tracks the water in the landscape across the whole country. And you see here the region of Menindee Lakes. And we've looked at where the water was through time and then summarized that in terms of its presence. So this is not in itself a flood model. It's just another set of observations. But it's, in turn, going to inform and calibrate a lot of our understanding of where water is throughout the country, and that's very important because we don't have good observation networks everywhere. All right, my final key messages. I think we are the challenge to living with hydrometeorological extremes. We are impacted and we mind. The extremes are, climate change aside, are reasonably natural. They'll keep on coming. There's not a lot we can do to stop them, but we are the ones that are in harm's way and need to figure out how to deal with that. I'd like to argue that a good, thorough understanding of the way that we are impacted by them is very important to our ability to mitigate. Quantitative risk models can certainly help deliver sustainable ways of dealing with that. There is a lot of progress through improved data, quality of data, but also improved models and the high computing environments to run those models, and that's very important. However, I think there are also significant challenges and gaps that remain. I think there's a lot of pieces of the puzzle that we still don't really fully understand or only kind of make a stab at approximating. And I think another issue that's quite important is our ability to really nail down the uncertainty in the models that we use. And that becomes especially important when you start bolting together the engineering models from the vulnerability with some of the very sophisticated physical models of the hazard and the statistical models of the exposure. What does that mean, the uncertainty? How does that translate into our decision making? And then finally, I think there is a massive opportunity that we should try and realize as a nation in the next few years around coordination of consistent, high-quality, high-priority data and information, and making that information accessible in such a way that's not just available, but also actually usable by the people who need to make the decisions. So I'd like to keep it there, but very happy to pick this up in discussion. Thanks.
Thank you, Martine. We'll move straight along to Norm Miller, who will provide a perspective, an ACT perspective. I can see you there.
Thanks, Albert. I'm going to focus more on the ACT area. Everyone's seen a lot about Australia-wide, I suppose. Keep it pretty local and keep it to the issues from a practitioner's point of view, or from not so much the consultant, but for those of us that actually do the flood studies and look at the data and those sorts of things. Okay. So the greatest challenges we're looking at drought is, need to be prepared for a severe event, I suppose. In the ACT, there's the ACT water strategy. It's been planned out. One of the comments that was in there was looking at only a 1 year in every 20 year to be restricted. Again, that's taking probably an average component, and we know that doesn't work like that. We've got periods of drought, periods of flood, so you're going to have a series of restrictions like we've been through. But on average, that's how it's going to be. And we need to allow for increased population growth. Everyone knows there's a projection of increased population. We're looking at over 500,000 people in the ACT by 2050 of that sort of order, and probably going up to 700,000. But we need to lower the per capita demand on that. And the ACT solution, of course, everyone knows, was increase the cost of water, put in a new dam, and take some water out of the Murrumbidgee River. But water use has significantly changed since the 90s, and that's a 30-year planning horizon that was looked at from that. And that was fine. Canberra's inland city. We don't have desal plants and those sorts of things. The question I'm sort of looking at is, what about multi-generational planning? We always look out at 30 or 50 years. So the challenge I'd be considering is, what do you do in 100 years? We built a dam. We're taking water out. When we get to that population forecast of 500,000 to 700,000, we need more water. What do we do? Possibly look at another dam or some other recycle mechanism. But that needs to be in some long-term forecast. And then, of course, you've got the ongoing components of that, which is looking at, what are the environmental flows going to be? Looking at vegetation, biodiversity, the impact on the aquatic system. And, of course, the impact of drought is going to have an impact on your bushfire management. We're already going through that process in the ACT. And those systems, those natural systems, may not easily adapt. They're already struggling, as everyone is aware of, in various areas. So it's not just about the engineering side of it. You definitely have to look at how the environment's going to respond. What I've just done here, looking at it, is this is just how does the water supply affect the yield. We just did a quick plot. Looking here, this black one, this was 40 years worth of data in the Cotter catchment prior to the 2003 flood event. We go and plot up these extra years post. The R squares really don't mean much here. And there's a lot of hidden signals in that data that have to be teased out, I suppose. But essentially, we've got this period here where the yield has dropped, obviously because of vegetation regrowth and those sorts of things. We get up to the 10, 11, 12 years, which Rob talked about, where the yield is increasing, but again, only one of them in the high level of yield, again, probably due to the vegetation regrowth. In 2006 was our driest year in the ACT, and we're getting out to this very low yield component. But one of the key messages there, though, is that it doesn't go to zero. It's no rainfall, no yield. You actually have a component here that the system, the catchment, requires about 400 millimetres of rain a year, or you're really not going to get much runoff. So if we get this area here in our drought, and these droughts start to tend down to this area here, you're going to have a significant yield issue in your catchment. So we could have the dams and everything there, but the water might not even get to it. But again, that's part of the drying strategy. Again, something that possibly needs to be looked at. Apart from the surface water, we look at the groundwater, obviously. I know it's a messy plot, but again, it's this one goes back, again, the 40 years. We've had some pretty big rainfall, so it's zero rainfall starting at 50 going down to over 200 mils, and that's in a monthly rainfall. So this is 10, 11, 12 in here. Quite significant rainfall events have occurred prior to it. But this is, and this was our groundwater. This is at Auroral Valley up near the Cotter catchment. It's impacted, was impacted by the fire as well. You can see the impact or the drop. This is a water level drop here, about 5 metre drop during the drought. Then we had the big rainfall events, and it got close to where it was going to be, or where it had been before. And then we're again starting to trend down. But just looking at the fact that groundwater is a significant component that needs to be considered. So we're going to move straight on to the floods now. And what are the challenges that we need to cope with floods? Well, water quantity is usually okay. You know, when a flood hits, we've got more than enough water. But it's the quality that's an issue, and also the repair that you need to do after the flood's gone. And these are going to become more frequent. So this is our, this is probably about 200 metres from here. This is Sullivan's Creek at the ANU. This is just over a little walkway crossing. This was in February this year. And again, there's already damage that was created from that event. Not a major event, probably a 5-year event or so, but these are going to become more common, so a lot more repair work. This is going into Tuggeranong Lake. A whole lot of material was washed in, and that just sits there, and then you've got all the water quality issues associated with that. The bottom one here, we're just looking at Cotter Dam prior to construction, but this is the event after the fires. You know, we've got a huge sediment load that comes in. You don't notice it down the bottom end, and but that, again, will become more frequent. And, of course, you've got the floods during construction. That generally happens, I think it's, because you go through a period of drought, everyone panics, so you've got to build the dam, and then during the construction of the dam, the drought breaks and flood hits. That just happened to have happened in the ACT for the last two dams. So Googong overtopped in 76, and when they increased the dam wall for the Cotter Dam in 51, had the same thing happen. So the other issue is not so much just the extreme event, but the more frequent localised flooding. So in the ACT, the localised storms are much more of an issue than a riverine, a flood going down the Murrumbidgee. No one's living right on the Murrumbidgee. And this is creating a fair bit of havoc with the locals, I suppose. So the complaints that you're going to get through to the government that it has to respond to is generally going to be from localised flooding. The 100-year event, well, it comes, people, we deal with it, and then it sort of goes again. These events are occurring just about every year. And we didn't have that many floods up until this drought broke. In the last 3 years, we've had 5 major events coming through. Some of them were started off at a 100-year event at the top of the catchment. By the time it gets to the bottom of catchment, it's 1 in 5-year event, but quite significant, and that's happened in 3 catchment areas. And the increase, looking at the increase due to climate change, has already been talked about and how you can look at it. We've just recently been involved with looking at Sullivan's Creek. Again, and one of the scenarios is, what happens if you increase rainfall intensity? We looked at, say, 30%, because 10 and 20 we didn't think was going to be a major one, so let's just see what 30% does. The key message, though, is, if I could get the right button, this was looking at what's the water level change that's going to be created, and we're not just looking at a 100-year event, we're looking at even 10-year events. So the one on the left was looking at, you know, 0.1 metres over here, some stuff down here, point, you know, up around the 0.3 metre or something through the main channels coming through the system. That's a 1 in 10-year event. You look at the 100-year event, you're going to get a similar sort of scenario. But what starts to appear that's a bit different is you start getting more of the overland flow systems breaking out. So the 1 in 5 and 1 in 10-year capacity pipe networks that you've got, well, they start to get overwhelmed a little more often. So if we start increasing that rainfall intensity, you're going to get a bit more overland flow. Again, people are going to start getting a lot more upset because, well, insurance probably won't cover some of that overland flow because of the definition of a flood having to come from a riverine flood network. But that was just to try and get an idea, you know, what does 30% increase mean in these intensities? So we're looking at up to around 0.5 metre increase or so. Just a ballpark figure, you know, very preliminary. So the solutions and how to implement it. Well, we've talked about models. They're becoming a lot more complex. But the issue is there's not a lot of data. So if you want a complex model, you're going to need a lot more information. So calibration becomes critical. And I've seen some projects and the models that have become very complex, and a lot of assumptions had to be very simple in those complex models. So you increase one aspect, you have to decrease the other because you don't have a lot of information. And they become a lot more sensitive as well. Some of the old 1D models, dimensional models, you could change the parameters and you could easily see some sort of correlation that was logical. In some of the other models, you've got to be very careful of how it changes. So the designs you do have to be adaptable to what the variability is that we're going to expect. And when we're looking at, so don't just design for what a median, a mean, quartiles, you know, the extreme events are in your outliers. And a lot of information now, you see a lot of people starting to quote the mean, median or something like that. Well, these extreme events are on the outside, so your extremes can change quite a bit, but your average can stay the same. And that's what you have to be careful of. And then estimate and understand the tipping points of the limits of what your system's going to be. We're certainly finding that that part comes to be a bit of an issue as to understanding the process of what's actually going on. So you do actually hit some points in the modelling where, you know, things do change. And looking at the knowledge, the skills, the information and the training that's required, we're looking at experienced practitioners. They're retiring. We're all getting a bit old. And there's a much lower number coming through the ranks. It used to be that you'd start off as a civil engineer and you get into hydrology and you work the way through that sort of system, where you come through a science background. But there's a different background knowledge that came through, and you'd always work with someone that had a lot of experience. That experience is now starting to disappear, so those aspects have to be somehow conserved. So the skills through experience need to be transferred. And we found that, you know, the whole generation that's coming through is a lot more dynamic. People don't hold the job down as long anymore. If you get into a job, you don't hold it for life. So people are changing jobs every 2 to 5 years, so transferring the skills through. You know, I've trained quite a few people and they move on and into different areas and different companies, which is great, but then you're sort of starting back again. So we're looking at how that information has to be transferred. So, and this is apart from all the data and everything else that we're talking about, so this is just touching on, you know, let's not forget about the skills that are out there already. And training is limited to the timeline and budget pressure. So in the practical area now and consulting area, this has become a real issue in the last couple of years, certainly post-GFC. A lot of mining areas, components, you know, they all had the money before. Now the governments are becoming a lot tighter on their budgets. So the general scenario is, let's try and give it to the cheapest person to try and do the job, give them a little bit of guidance and hope they progress through, and then you get to the end of a job and you start finding all the little issues that have to be redone. So there's a lot of pressure in there to do that. So looking at certification or some sort of competency required for the staff doing it before they even get involved and go through that process. And there are some, you know, having hydrology courses or data analysis courses so they understand better the information that they're playing with. A lot of people are getting into the models now and given very little guidance. And, you know, there's not a lot of training in that area. And there's not a lot of, training in the academic area as well. There's not a lot of courses being done. You know, recently there was a water quality data analysis course that was done, but it was done in New Zealand. So we didn't actually have one here in Australia. So I think that's one of the big issues and concerns. And that's all there is for me, just to wrap it up. Thank you.
Okay, thanks to the speakers. You will have noticed we're now a little bit before 6:30. The speakers have agreed to stay back a bit longer to have some discussion with you. So I'm hoping that many of you can stay for a little while longer. If I can invite the speakers to take a seat on the stools provided, then I would say everyone get your rotten tomatoes out and we can start. So the floor is open for comments, statements, questions, clarifications, ideas. It might actually be helpful if you're able to clarify which of these you are debiting. We've got a question here at the front. So I should say the microphones are only for recording. So if you could still speak up, but this meeting is recorded.
Speak through that mic so that people can hear.
Yes, you can do that, but if everyone does that, it might get a bit awkward. Absolutely.
Thank you. My name's Judy Ryan, and I'm a climate realist. And my question is to Professor Vertesi, and it's regarding the Wivenhoe Dam. Can you hear me out there? Right. As far as I remember, the dam was designed to catch the overflow from a dam further upriver to prevent flooding if there was torrential rain, further upriver. But during a drought some years ago, not that long ago, the Queensland government kept the Wivenhoe Dam not sufficiently empty enough to be able to catch the overflow from the when extreme rain occurred at the end of the drought. The result of that policy decision was disastrous flooding, houses destroyed and lives lost. So my question to you, Professor Vertesi, is whose advice was the Queensland government acting on regarding rainfall predictions?
Okay. I'm not going to ask Professor Vertesi to answer that question because I don't think that it is necessarily his responsibility. But having said that, if any of the panel members wants to make a comment about the general question that was just put, please be welcome to do so.
Look, I'll just make a basic comment. The operation of the dam is the province of the dam engineers employed by the Queensland government. So the Bureau's responsibility is to issue rainfall forecasts for the period, but they actually aren't used in the reservoir operation. In fact, the assumption that the engineers use is to regard all of the rainfall that has happened and to compute the inflows into the dam based on what has happened. But as I understand it, is to actually forecast no further further rainfall for the duration of the event. Now, one of the points I was trying to make in my presentation was that I think in the future we're approaching a point now where the models have got sufficient reliability that in fact they could be used in the future in standard operating procedure, and I think could help actually to avert similar problems in the future. But that's in no way to be regarded as a criticism of the work that those dam engineers did in those circumstances at that time with the tools and the intelligence that they had at their disposal.
Okay, thanks. We got a question in the back there.
Sorry,
We'll take that as a comment. Can I get the person in the back?
Hello, Martin, Rob, Norm. Thank you, Norm, for raising the issue of lowering skill levels. And it's a question I was going to ask of Martin and Rob before you came along. And are the Bureau and Geoscience Australia seeing a decline in quantitative skills, abilities to address their challenge in intelligence and highly sophisticated issues we need to develop? We all agree they need to be developed, addressed properly, but has the Bureau or GA seen a lack in a skill coming along? And are there ways to address it? Are there ways to address it?
Martin, can I ask you to address that question?
Sure. I think from my perspective, we don't necessarily see a lack of skill, but I think I would recognise that the particular skill sets that Norm was talking about are slightly different, and that kind of level of practitioner experience is not something we necessarily looking at in our field. So I think within the limits of the recruiting options, we haven't seen any issue of getting the right skills. I think it is definitely an issue to get the right experience on the job that we do see as well. That's about as much as I can say. I think a lot of it is about, for us, retaining people long enough to actually groom them on the job in the particular application of a reasonably generic skill set in our context. And as Norm indicated, stopping them from leaving if we can, one way or another.
Yeah. Thank you. Question in the back there. Norm, can I put that question to you?
Insurance Council of Australia has been involved. There's been a fair bit of work that has been done for that, and a lot of it is in the definition of flood and trying to get flood maps done for significant areas of urbanised and key regional areas. And they want to put that up onto a website so people are aware of what the current status is for the flood modelling, I suppose. And then so the idea is to be more transparent as to which areas they believe are flood prone, and there's a whole lot of conjecture about that. But as I understand it, certainly the Insurance Council is attempting to get more information out there.
Okay. Would any of the other panel members want to comment on that? Or?
No, that's... And insurance also undertakes a reasonable amount of modelling themselves, but in terms of flood, they're very heavily relying on the studies that are done locally. So, yeah.
Okay. Sir?
Well, this is my first time to a lecture like this or a public debate about these sorts of issues, and I must express a bit of confusion and disappointment in use of language. The head of the Bureau of Met, I have always seen that organisation as a forecaster of weather. The term weather was not used once in the whole presentation. Everything was climate, even year-on-year comparisons. Look, I'm a geologist. I look at the long term, and I can tell you, over the last 500 million years, that the time when multicellular life flourished on Earth, climate changed hundreds of times. Not on one of those occasions was it driven by carbon dioxide. Not once. Now, you say that it is now, and you may be right, but the thing is, you haven't shown that. You haven't shown the evidence that carbon dioxide drives the climate.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to take that as a comment because we're not here to talk about climate or climate change. There's a gentleman in the back there.
Thanks for your presentation. I really enjoyed it. I was wondering whether in the future when there's going to be extended droughts and extended wet periods, if that occurs, whether there might be, particularly in Canberra, a net increase in the amount of water available or a net decrease?
Norm, can I hand that to you?
Tough question. Looking at the increased evaporation rate, you expect that there possibly could be a net increase in summer runoff, but I think the heat and the reduced rainfall, I don't know, what do you think of it?
Look, the middle latitudes are problematic. There's a lot of evidence to show... Not evidence, sorry. There's a lot of alignment in the models suggesting that these middle latitudes are going to be drier. But that's counterbalanced by occasional excursions of the monsoon coming down from the north every now and again. So if I were betting on the future, and it's a rough guess only, really, because the models don't give sufficient... confidence, I suppose. I'd be saying we'd be having longer spells of dry periods, but interspersed with some very significant floods with those kind of monsoonal rains coming down. In fact, the last few rains, big floods that you spoke of, I think most of those would have been associated with northwest cloud bands.
Yes.
Coming down from the tropics. So tropical rain really coming down and affecting the southern regions. We're probably going to see more of that in the future.
Yeah. Okay. The gentleman sitting next to you, who I was hoping to give the question to originally. Yep.
Hello. Peter Hersine here. And thanks to the speakers. Very good overviews, folks. One issue I'd like to take up with the panel, and possibly, Rob, you could lead off, is to talk about tropical cyclones and their tracking down the east and west coasts of Australia. The Bureau has a fascinating historical summary published on its website of the track of historical cyclones and how they've changed over the time. Remarkably, there are historical cyclones, or at least tropical lows, which have tracked over the New South Wales coast. Is there a prognosis for changes in the distributions of these tracks? And if so, if you could comment on the impact that it would have on extreme hydrologic events.
That's a good question. Look, interestingly, in the last few decades, if anything, we've seen less tropical cyclones than average for the decades prior. And again, the model projections are indicating that we are also likely to see a lesser number in the future, though with the exception that a good chance that some of the particularly intense high-impact ones, we may see a few more of those in the future. So that's what the model projections are suggesting. One of the difficulties with tropical cyclones is that there's not very many of them. And our record is getting better every year as satellite methods are improving, and we get better resolution in the satellite imagery, so therefore we can track the shape and the track of these things a lot better. But we've only been in the satellite era since the 1960s. So I think we get an average of about 11 in the Australasian region every year. So that's not a very big database when you go back to the 1960s, and probably really from the late 70s onwards is when we got the really, you know, good quality records. So it is hard to actually make some generalisations, but we do know that every now and again one of these cyclones goes to a place where you don't expect it to go. And there are a couple of classics, like one hitting the Gold Coast region in the 1950s. Back in those days, there wasn't much there. But to pick up on Martin's point, you know, the vulnerability has changed a hell of a lot since then. So, you know, if we have a serious cyclone square up on the Gold Coast with all those canal estates and so on, then the consequent impacts can be so much greater than they could in the past. It's interesting on the West Coast too to see how far south they go. You know, it's not out of the question to anticipate something, you know, hitting Perth one day. Now, that may or may not have anything to do with climate change per se. That might be, again, I want to come back to what I said earlier in the talk, that, you know, our climate record isn't actually that long, and we shouldn't expect there to be no surprises because of that modest length of record. So cyclones will be the kind of gotcha, I suspect, that could surprise us.
Thank you. Lady at the front there.
It's more a comment, really, on what you were saying, Dr. Wolf. But it's something that is so ordinary, so everyday, that we forget about it. And that is that if people maintain their houses properly, they can go through drastic flooding, they can go through absolutely drastic cyclones and not see much damage. I remember going through Ayr about a fortnight after a cyclone had gone through there. That's in Queensland. And all the houses where the paintwork hadn't been done, where the fences weren't repaired, where the gates were swinging, you know, they were ruined. They were flattened. The house next door, a nice bungalow that someone had maintained, was in perfect condition. And that goes on to the second part of what I was going to say, but I think you've got to stress this more, that's all. The other part I was going to say is, don't let people build in floodplains. That is positively insane. It shouldn't be allowed. Thanks.
Martin, would you like to comment on that, or would you like to respond to that?
You said it very well.
There we go. Gentleman in the second row there.
Rob, I'm just wondering how much mitigation measures actually exacerbate flooding situations, like the building of levees and to protect towns. How much does that then impact on flooding in the surrounding areas?
Look, I'm not really not qualified to speak about it, to be honest. I think there would be quite a lot of site variation, though, in it. It would depend on the situation, the particular design of the levee system. You know, I can point to several examples where it has actually saved the bacon of a town. I'm less clear about situations where it may have exacerbated it. I understand there are a bit of both, but you really have to talk to a, you know, levee engineer.
Norm, would you perhaps like to comment on that? I mean, There's this idea that by you know, getting floods out of our way, we might just pass them on quicker to the people downstream, for instance. Ideas like that, or?
Well, I think certainly in the ACT, the idea is to get the flood out of there as quick as you could. There's a lot of concrete channels. And part of that was to reduce the land take, allow more development. It wasn't seen as a major safety issue at the time. There's certainly a couple of little levee banks around. The issue with a levee bank is that if you design it for a certain flood level, being a 100-year flood level, and then you don't take into account what happens above that, you have a potential issue. So you have to look at what happens if you get a 1,000 year or 10,000 year and that levee breaks. And that's where part of that issue comes from, in terms of which areas are vulnerable when that happens. And that's the main component for your levee embankment, is don't just design it for your 100 year. And this is what I was saying about the skill and experience and trying to get people there to say, well, what happens if I get a 10,000 year? But again, you know, various pressures around that. But you have to take that into account.
Thanks. Gentleman in the back.
I had a question, well, maybe for all the panelists, but Rob, early on in your presentation, you talked about the fact that maybe not all the possible climates that we might experience have appeared in the historical record. And I'm just wondering, from the perspective of all the panelists, have we taken those kind of possible new combinations of climates into account in our consideration of things like engineering for floods and thinking about disaster vulnerability? In other words, maybe there are, I guess, unknown unknowns that we haven't really taken into account. And is that kind of, perhaps, I guess, what we geologists call the no analog condition? How is that being taken into account in disaster planning?
Martine, can I give you?
Sure. Well, I'd like to say we do. I mean, we certainly try to. In the kind of long-term risk modeling that we do, that's exactly what we are trying to do. And we do that, for example, by trying to bring the understanding of the physics to bear on understanding the potential range. So unlikely you'll get a cyclone all the way down to Tasmania because of the physics of the system. But we can try and stretch the limits of the observed and fill in the gaps. We haven't seen a cyclone at every location on the coast. We could certainly model what they would look like if they hit in between where we've seen them. And we may get it wrong, but our understanding has improved a lot over the last 30 years. So I will give you an example. Hurricane Sandy there in New York, was a lot of argument around that that was unforeseen. That's not true. I know various people who've modeled that scenario. The question is whether it had been taken into account by the planners, but certainly in the insurance industry where a lot of people had seen that one coming. So I think the answer is we try, but there are always going to be black swans, as I would have said before I came to Australia, and I realise everybody expects them here. Yes, unfortunately, yes, we try, but we sometimes fail.
Norm, what about from your sort of practitioner's point of view? So there's the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns, so to speak, and you know, the freak events, how do they enter into practice?
It's all a matter of risk. Determining what sort of risk you want to take, I suppose, and what level of mitigation you can, you know, what you can afford, or what the community can afford, and how you deal with it. So whether it's going to be foreseen or not, cyclones, different area, and those sorts of things. But certainly if you're in a cyclone zone, there's different codes and everything about that, and you have to account for a fair bit of it. And that risk reduces as you come further south in latitude. But I think it's down to that it's the vulnerability of where you're at.
Rob, what about forecasting events that haven't happened before? Is there a problem there getting people to prepare for events they haven't seen before?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, as you would well know, as being a hydrologic modeller, how difficult it is to convince yourself, actually, that you're seeing something, authentic in the model output, even when you've got validation data. It's so much harder when you're speculating about what it might be if you're not on solid ground with data. Having said that, I think we are overall in this industry, we are making good progress by going back and better capturing data that, in fact, has been observed, but not necessarily pressed into practice for a lot of the design estimates. And the rainfall intensity frequency duration stuff that I mentioned earlier is a great example of that, in fact, where we've hugely enhanced the size of the database to arrive at what we now know to be, or believe to be, a much more realistic and authentic description of our rainfall IFD spectra. So, you know, I think overall, you know, practice is improving because of, you know, better techniques and we're getting better at finding data and putting it through the mill.
Great. A lot of questions there. The gentleman at the...
I think my question is for you, Albert, and also for Bob, perhaps, and it's about the question of that flip-flop between drought and then flood. Now, it seems to me, from my interest in Australian literature, we've had quite a bit of that over time. And I just wondered whether, in fact, there's really been much research done. I know, we have to rely on records like, Burke in 1896 had a temperature of about 48 degrees. That at that time, the number of deaths in Sydney had doubled. People obviously weren't drinking enough water and having air conditioning back then. We had a Gundagai washed away in 1852 and then another big flood in 1853. So how much work is there done on looking back on some of those records you can find in literature, as well as those previous records we do have from newspapers and so on, and of course all of the official met data?
Look, from my perspective, I think Rob said it all when he said that Australia's got a relatively short record since European settlement. There hasn't been a lot of records kept, but there have been some records kept. But really, the intensive data age, where we know reasonably well what's been going on, is only the last 100 years or so, as Rob said. So that really limits your options of knowing the past and therefore being able to predict, what might actually happen in the future. Rob, you want to...
Yeah, I'd probably add two things. Look, I think there's been some really interesting historical studies that have been done on hydrometeorological extremes. The SURGE project, I think, was one of these, and it's taking, going back into the deeper record. It has been claimed that the Bureau doesn't publish, some of the very long-term records, focusing on this... ACORN data set that we published that only goes back to 1910. Now, that is our holistic continental climate data set, but in fact we do publish a lot of data going back to the middle of the 19th century for areas where we have the data, and that's freely available online. And people are using that to tell these stories about the movement from dry into wet phases and so on. And some of the more recent climate modelling science is now looking at some of the drivers for that flip-flopping behaviour, and a big one is in the energy balance of the Pacific Ocean, for instance, and the long-term trends associated with the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, for instance, which, is all about the transfer of heat through one side of the Pacific to the other and the cycles that sets up. There's a massive amount of kind of energy momentum in the oceans, and the way in which that energy sloshes around turns out to be a very, very significant determinant of the weather that we actually get. So I wouldn't say it's all worked out yet, but I think there's actually some very productive lines of research that are now seeking to explain why is it that we flip-flop between these desiccated periods and these saturated periods.
It would be really good if you could produce a good paper which has been looking at some of that historical stuff, because it really is there. There's an awful lot of newspaper stuff. I know you're careful about what you assess as being a record that you can really do a number on, but that's what we've got to work with, and true. I think it's pretty useful.
Yep, I agree. There's a great role for historians in all this. It isn't just a meteorologist problem.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. A valuable comment. We've got time for one or two last questions. Lady Beck. Sorry, I didn't get the question. Could you repeat it a little bit louder?
The pole, evidence suggests that the pole is melting, and particularly the non-pole is melting at an exponential rate.
Right.
If the pole melts, what happens to the weather?
All right, but if somebody wants to comment on that, you're welcome. It's more of a climate science question, really. But does anyone want to comment?
I might just pass a quick comment. It's probably a little less clear what it does for the weather at a particular point like where we live. Its chief effect, though, is going to be on rising sea levels. So there's many metres of global sea level tied up in the polar ice sheets. And they are melting, but it is highly unlikely that we will see anything more than about half a metre rise in the world's oceans in the next 100 years, because there's a there's a lot of inertia. Although we do see significant melting in both poles, it will take a while until that all finds its way into the ocean. May never do so, but we can expect to see increasing sea levels for the foreseeable future.
It's just, my understanding is that the weather's driven by the hot pole.
I might ask you to take that discussion to the informal discussion afterwards, and you can perhaps talk directly about this. At this point, I want to make room for one last question. The gentleman has it. Is it about water?
In terms of black swan events, as mentioned by my team, is anybody at all, even one person, especially maybe in GA, which has a longer term view of things rather than the bomb, is anybody looking at the flip side of global warming? And that's global cooling.
No, we don't work on that. That is in the realm of the CSIRO Bureau. So we don't do that kind of work.
I think Maurice Newman is also making a career out of it. So maybe read some of his work. I'm going to ask the panelists to respond briefly, if you can, to the three big questions we had on here. And then we'll go for informal drinks. So the first question is, what will be the greatest challenges to coping with droughts and floods over the next decades? Martin, if I can start with you, what do you see as the greatest challenge? Will it, and I guess the general question, is it more of the same, or are there some big new developments or risks that you can see?
I think we're getting to the point where we're realizing we can't carry on as we are. So without necessarily changing anything in the way that they come, the challenges, it's our, the greatest challenge is dealing with them better, I think, in a significantly better way.
Norm?
Yeah, I'll just follow on from that. And I suppose policy is one of the key issues. If these droughts and floods are going to change, policy has to keep up. So there's always a big lag between a lot of the policy and the practical side of it. So I think that's going to be one of the key challenges, and then you've got the whole modelling side as well.
Robert, do you see as the big challenges?
I would go to policy responses as well, as the vulnerability and hence the consequences of these droughts and floods is increasing all the time. There's a lot more pressure now on government to actually put in place either, everything from relief arrangements through to new regulatory regimes and so on. I think it's getting much, much tougher for government now to come up with responses.
Right. Thanks. And if I can roll the last two questions in one, what new solutions are available? How can they be implemented? And I guess as a corollary, what new information, knowledge, skills and training will be required to do that? Again, Martin, can I ask your views on that?
Yeah, I make a plug for more climate scientists and other engineers with quantitative skills and who can operate and leverage the new data and methods that are available.
Norm?
I think it's having access to the data, the whole range of data, just not individual, two-dimensional spatial stuff, but on a three-dimensional space, so how things are changing through the climate elevations and how that's working. And looking at the new information, certainly from the droughts and the flood point of view, I think generally a lot of the flood modelling at the moment is looking at floods that are spatially distributed over a whole catchment. And I think we need to get into, as the climate's going into, a lot of the storm patterns, is to having models that can actually have a storm move over a catchment in that sort of direction. But having the information to do that.
Right. And finally, Rob?
Look, I think we're living in a really exciting time, in fact, where we are getting access to better and better information all the time. Just this afternoon, a Japanese rocket fired into the sky, delivering Japan's next generation weather satellite. It's going to give six times more frequent images of the weather systems around our part of the world, at least. Four times greater spatial resolution and six times greater spectral resolution. The government's invested in a new supercomputer for the Bureau that's going to greatly enhance our ability to run our numerical weather prediction models at finer and finer resolution and enhance their skill further. They're just a couple of examples of this great technological change that's happening that I think is going to put humanity in a much, much better position to anticipate some of these things. So whilst hydrometeorology extremes may be getting more extreme, I think our ability to anticipate them and plan for them and respond to them is improving.
Thank you. Well, on that hopeful message, I'd like to thank all of the panellists, Martin Wolf, Norm Miller and Rob Fratesi, for speaking to us today. And drinks are outside, and we can talk more about new solutions outside.